Getting on to our program, I'm going to introduce Gloria Meyer, who is our publicity person, but also on the healthcare committee, to introduce our speakers.
As you all know, for at least the last 9 months or more, we have been consumed by the discussions over healthcare reform. They have been complicated, confusing, and frustrating. We hope that this forum will clarify what has happened and give us some insight into what could happen on the national scene. I've spent a good share of my summer and fall working on this, as some of you know, and even I, who looks into this every day, I'm confused. We also realize that changes are being made in Wisconsin that we are probably unaware of. And this is an excellent time to see what the current state is in terms of healthcare reform in Wisconsin and where it is going. And maybe we can speculate a little bit about how the federal bill could impact the state and vice versa. We have two experts in the field with us, and I will introduce them now and ask you to hold your questions until the end of the presentation. They've both got, you know, resumes that go on forever, so I'm just hitting a few of the highlights because, take my word for it, they're experts. First, Robert Craig is Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin, which is a grassroots organization dedicated to making Wisconsin a better place to live and work. He has been with the organization for 3 years. For the past 10 years, Dr. Craig has been working to make healthcare reform a top issue in Wisconsin. In 2009, Dr. Craig was awarded the Consumer Health Advocate of the Year Award, and the Wisconsin State Assembly gave him a special citation for his work in promoting health care reform in Wisconsin. I view that as an accomplishment. He has authored 7 reports on various aspects of the health care crisis. He has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Karen Timberlake was appointed Secretary of the Department of Health Services, formerly the Department of Health and Family Services, in 2008. She has been with the department for 3 years. Prior to joining Department of Health Services, Ms. Timberlake was director of the Office of State Employment Relations. She has served in a number of capacities in state government, too many to mention, but this includes Assistant Attorney General from 1995 to 2000, and important to our discussion, she chaired the Governor's Task Force on Autism in 2004 and served on the State Group Insurance Board from 2000 to 2007. So as you can see, the people we have with us know what they're talking about. So I am going to leave and let them continue. First, we'll hear from Dr. Craig and then Ms. Timberlake. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I will try to speak into this thing. This looks like it's more of a rock and roll microphone. It seems you have to talk directly into it. Actually, maybe, can you hold it? Okay, I think that's better. Okay. So, great to be here, and this is a beautiful building. The last time I was here, I think, was about 4 years ago. I was invited by Midge Miller here to speak at the Madison Institute, and so that was a great discussion, but this is a really nice facility, and it's great to be here, and I know a lot of Midge's friends are here in the audience. I know some of you probably were, when you planned this forum, thought you were going to be able to have a discussion of what had already passed and what it meant for Wisconsin and how we would implement it. And we're disappointed that we're still in process, so to speak, up in Washington. Now, I actually think I can tell you what will be in the bill that will, I would say, most likely occur. I'll explain. So I just got back from Washington, D.C. last week. And have the inside on what the legislative strategy is and what's likely to come through this process. A bill is expected by Easter. That's the new, I guess, the new Christmas, the new Thanksgiving, and the new August, etc. And hopefully it'll be true this time. A lot of, and I'll get into this a little bit and do more of it in Q&A, a lot of what's going to be in this bill likely is going to leave a lot of latitude to the states. And so the fact that we have a very innovative Department of Health Services, and Karen Timberlake has led a lot of great innovations, some of them which have become law, some of them they're in the planning process, will be very helpful to us. And so I think that Wisconsin will be very well positioned, if we can get this done, to be one of the leaders. We're going to need that. Implementation is going to be a lot of the game, not just passing the bill. And so we're very well positioned on that. I think you all know that we don't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, and that we, because of our arcane 19th century rules, you need 60 votes in the Senate in order to even vote on a bill, which is probably not workable in the 21st century, but nonetheless, the Senate is a very tradition-bound institution. And so, but there is a way, we actually have bills passed in both houses. By the way, in all previous health care reform debates, no bill had ever reached the floor, full comprehensive bill, let alone passed a House of Congress. We have two bills that passed the House of Congress that are probably about 80% the same bill, or very similar. The similarities are greater than the differences. Now, what this means is that if the House was to simply pass the Senate bill, I don't think the Senate bill is as good, but if they were to do that, it wouldn't need to go back to the Senate, and it would go to the President's desk. Now, the House won't do that because there are a number of things they wanted in conference committee, some number of important issues, affordability being a big issue, the excise tax on higher cost insurance policies that would discriminate against a lot of public workers and union workers is an issue that's in the Senate bill. But there's a way to still change that bill as they were doing in conference committee anyway and not have to get 60 votes. And that is called the budget reconciliation process. And in fact, anyone know what COBRA is? Well, you can, COBRA is named after this. It was the Congressional Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1986, I believe. So reconciliation was used for welfare reform, for the Bush tax cuts, for a number of other things that only requires a majority. 50 senators plus Vice President Biden would be enough. And so the idea is this. In fact, Senator Al Franken is now calling this. I saw him in person describe this as pass and pledge. You could also call it pledge and pass. And that is the House will pass the Senate bill, but the Senate will agree at the same time to pass a budget reconciliation bill that will make the changes that would have occurred in conference committee anyway that would satisfy the House. So you'd end up with a unified bill and never have to go back to the Senate. And so that is the strategy right now. The leadership is on board. The White House is on board. They're having to work a lot with members of Congress. There's a lot of skittishness after Massachusetts. I think President Obama's speaking tour, which has been very effective the last week, is partly designed to build up his ratings so that he'll have more credibility to get the 218 votes in the House. 218 votes in the House is probably the toughest thing right now. The 51 in the Senate's a little easier, though neither one's easy. But there's a reason I think this will happen, and that is politics. They've already taken the recorded roll call votes on these bills. They will already have ads run against them in 210 if they're up for re-election. All the members of Congress are. Some of the senators are. Their only real defense is to pass a bill and then explain it to their constituents. And the individual provisions of the bill are very popular if you poll them separately. The negative poll ratings on the bill itself have more to do with the process than the bill. And so you can't fight the attack that you took this vote on this terrible bill unless you have something to explain that you gave to your constituents. Furthermore, just the stench of failure will make it even worse in 210 if you haven't passed anything. So I think that logic, plus all of the reasons we need healthcare reform and all the economic reasons we need healthcare reform and all the fiscal reasons, we can't afford Medicaid long-term, we can't afford Medicare long-term without doing this. All of that put together will probably cause them, I would say, 60-40, 65-35 to get it done. The fact is, though, they should have got it done a long time ago. So you can't say just because it stands to reason logically and politically that they'll necessarily succeed. I heard people in D.C., some were thought it was 90-10 that it would pass. I think that's probably overly optimistic. The person that Ted Kennedy brought in from Massachusetts, John McDonough, to work on this process in the Senate thinks 90-10, and he led the whole fight for the Massachusetts bill that's been so prominent. But there is a very good chance, I would say. It's more likely than not, but it still is going to require a lot of engagement. So given that we know pretty much what the House wants in the reconciliation bill to change the Senate bill, we actually do know what will likely be in this bill. So let me review that briefly. I'll also leave a lot to Q&A on this as well, but let me give you a broad overview. I would say that there are three basic things this bill works on. It reforms the insurance market and outlaws a lot of the worst insurance industry practices. And these practices were already unpopular. They have become even more notorious during this debate. There is a very broad consensus on these practices. It also, and I'll talk about what some of those are, it increases coverage, it creates a lot more mechanisms for coverage, and also it tries to deal with cost and the cost curve, which is very crucial because we've had hyperinflation, we've had a 130% increase in health insurance premiums since the year 2000, which is unsustainable. In Wisconsin, by the year 2016, we will have, on average, $25,000 a year family health insurance policies, which is entirely unaffordable. Many people will lose their coverage, or and it'll be hollowed out if that happens. And that's not even talking about what that would do to the state budget or the national budget. And so the cost issue is very important. Let me talk about the insurance market. In the insurance market, you would outlaw a lot of the worst abuses, like discrimination based on age, pre-existing conditions, gender. Women pay 48% more than men. What you would do is, because the people who are most vulnerable, other than the uninsured are very vulnerable, are people in the small group market who are in small businesses, small nonprofits, like the one I work for. We just got a 35% increase from Humana, and we're shopping for insurance. And people on the individual market who face the worst, that's the Wild West of the insurance market. That's where you get your policy rescinded after the fact, after you have a major claim, because they find a pre-existing condition back in your record based on no objective standard. That is where they may carve out a part of your body in perpetuity because you had one issue with it at one point. So that's where there's the worst abuse. And the way that is dealt with, the bill is complicated. There are some things that are done right away, and there are some things that aren't done until 2014. They create a high risk pool in the short term for people to buy insurance who can't get good insurance now until we get to the full reform in 2014. But by 2014, the idea for middle-income people and upper-middle-income people is to create something called a National Health Insurance Exchange, which is a marketplace where people would buy insurance from private and for nonprofit insurance companies. The public option doesn't seem to be viable now. It's in the House bill, but it was not in the Senate bill because of the action of two senators, the 59th and the 60th vote, to get around the filibuster. But it would essentially provide group health insurance that, like what people get from large employers, to everyone who doesn't have access to that now. So people in small businesses, small nonprofits, the uninsured, people who buy it on their own from the insurance industry and are open to the worst abuses. And subsidies would provide to people on a sliding scale based on income, what's called affordability credits. And in fact, that's a major difference in the Senate and the House bill. The Senate bill is better for people roughly over $50,000 a year, $50,000 to $90,000 a year. The House bill is much better for people who are lower middle income, $30,000 to $50,000 a year. And so the thing the House wants is to combine the best of both and to make sure it's affordable for everyone. Senate bill is not very affordable for modest income people. And so people would go to that exchange, they could choose which insurance company they wanted, and there'd be nonprofit options, both national nonprofit options and state ones, such as the ones we have around here, like Dean Care, like Group Health Cooperative, etc. In addition, so you would have that, and you'd have standard benefits. You'd have maybe four levels of plan, and they would cover all necessary care. You decide which one you wanted. They would not be complicated plans, so you didn't know that there were all these gotyas in there. Right now, it's very hard to tell if you're an individual market what you're buying and what's covered until you make a claim. And even if it's covered, they might find a way not to meet the claim. The other thing it does, and so that provides more access to more secure coverage. There's also an expansion of coverage, both in the exchange for moderate income and middle income people, but also there's an expansion of Medicaid in this bill. And we think, and by the way, this state has been extremely innovative expanding Medicaid and the Child Health Insurance Program. And our BadgerCare program is one of the best in the whole country. And it's all been done during the Doyle administration and under Karen that's continued to be innovative. But we've done a lot more than other states. We just this year got into trying to cover childless adults. And right away, 68,000 people, is that right, signed up? And we got the cap, and now we have 18,000 people on the waiting list because the state just doesn't have the money to cover the additional people. The House bill would cover people up to 150% of poverty, And the Senate, 133% of poverty. We hope we end up at 150% of poverty, and would pay for all of the expansion at first and 90% after that. And so it would take a lot of economic pressure off the states, because it's a real issue, and Karen may talk about this, about the state without the federal government participation actually be able to afford this long term with the state fiscal crisis. So the idea is essentially in this bill, and it's not the perfect bill, even if you combine them, but it's probably the best. A combination of these bills is the best our political system can produce at this point in American history. And it is a major advance. It does a whole lot of things that we've never been able to do, that we've tried to do. And it's a lot of things you can't do except in a comprehensive bill. It would be hard to do as individual measures. But it's still, so you have more, you're going to have what more choice, more peace of mind where people have more options. It'll create a lot more economic mobility, because right now a lot of people keep an individual job for their whole family because it has access to health insurance. And they're one job loss away, one illness away, one change in their life away, like need to take time off to care for a sick parent or a sick child, what have you, from being unprotected. And then 60% of all bankruptcies are medically related. And if we have a way to get high quality coverage that's relatively affordable, that creates a whole lot more economic mobility. And there are a lot of, and frankly, it's going to be a bigger economic engine than people realize. So it's very important that we have choice, people want control of their healthcare decisions, and that we have peace of mind, where people have access to quality coverage. But none of it's going to work long term unless we get costs under control. And the thing with costs is we pay more than double per capita what any other Western country, major developed country pays, and we have a very inefficient system. There is very good research to show that up to a third, maybe by some estimates even a half of medical spending in this country is not value added, that we have some parts of the country, some hospitals, where double, triple is spent for the same diagnosis for worse outcomes. The high utilization areas have worse outcomes. So it's not about quality, it's about fragmentation. We don't have good case management, we don't track and give appropriate care to each person. We don't do chronic disease management, preventive care very well. We emphasize specialty care and intervention later in the process and uncoordinated. And it costs a great deal of money. So we know, based on the Dartmouth Atlas research on Medicare, that for some diagnoses in Miami, Florida, they spend 10 times more than La Crosse, Wisconsin for worse results. In fact, the money is flowing to those high utilization areas. And so rather than have Congress just create new standards, create a new payment system, it's partly because we pay based on billable incidents, which are either highly specialized, and we don't pay for things that are important, like a doctor or a nurse practitioner actually tracking a patient and working with them to navigate through the system and make sure they're getting good preventive care, good chronic disease management. We don't pay for that. We pay for the high-cost test and the specialty intervention. And so if we need to change the payment system to do that. One of the critiques of the plans, both the House and the Senate plan, is that they don't specifically in the bill lay out a new payment system. The problem is that would be unacceptable. It would be torn apart politically if it was done by Congress. And I don't think most people want members of Congress deciding that. What these bills do is they create commissions to develop new payment systems, to develop evidence-based medicine, and they set up processes that get around Congress trying to destroy it by putting forward new systems where Congress is about up or down, like base closure commission kind of setups. But they put in motion a way to change the way we pay for health care, starting with Medicare and also with the National Health Insurance Exchange. All of the attacks on the plan as cutting Medicare are very disingenuous. There is no provision to cut benefits in Medicare. There are provisions to reform the way we pay for Medicare so that it's more efficient and higher quality. There is an attempt to go after the excessive insurance company profits in the Medicare Advantage program, but that's appropriate. We're paying them a huge subsidy on top of what we pay for regular Medicare. It's just a straight-out subsidy to the insurance industry. And so that part of the plan is extremely important and has to happen, and it is done in the right way in that it creates a lot of commissions and procedures and processes that will create new payment systems without putting that out front in the bill and without having Congress actually set those standards, which I think would be politically unacceptable. So if we pass this bill, and I want to finish on this, the debate immediately gets to implementation and to the state. First of all, we believe that the opponents of this bill will try to prevent it from ever being implemented. should it pass. And there'll be an all-out effort to try to discredit the bill because it's not fully implemented until 2014 in the Senate bill. And so the fight will continue over how this gets done. And healthcare reform advocates are going to need to stay in the field in order to win implementation. And the states are going to have a ton of decisions to make. In the Senate bill, those national health insurance exchanges I talked about are state level. The state makes all sorts of decisions. In fact, the federal rules are a floor, not a ceiling. And so states like Wisconsin are in a position to lead the way on a lot of these. There's something in the Senate bill that was added called a medical loss ratio. Do people know what that is? Well, it's a good thing to end on because I want to get to the state and to Medicaid. Everyone's heard of the word pre-existing conditions, right? Even though it was not a word designed for public consumption, it's an insurance bureaucracy word, right? For illness, pre-existing condition, right? Well, insurance companies call what they have to spend for medical care a loss, medical loss ratio. So if you have a medical loss ratio of 76%, which is the medical loss ratio of United Healthcare, the largest private insurer in Wisconsin, then 76% of the money goes to actual medical bills, medical care, and 24% goes to United Healthcare in the form of administrative overhead, profits, what have you, administration, what have you. So the Senate bill is going to say that you have to have an 85% medical loss ratio. In fact, we could even try to make it higher in order to limit insurance company profits and make them more efficient. They don't like this very much at all. And in fact, the better plans, like your group health cares, your Dean cares, they're closer to a 95% medical loss ratio, the good nonprofit provider networks. So it would be good if we even made it higher. But what's going to happen then is that the insurance commissioners in the state, and I know that Karen's department works with Sean Dilwig a lot from the insurance commissioner here. We're lucky to have a good insurance commissioner. He's going to be in position to have to implement and enforce a lot of the new regulations on pre-existing conditions, on covering children, not excluding them based on pre-existing conditions, all of that, and on the exchanges. And so this is all going to start right away. And one of the questions right away is, how do you define what is administrative? Why do you define and versus medical care? Because they'll try to build all this administrative overhead costs into the medical care. So right away, a lot of big decisions and enforcement comes down to the state level. And the other big thing that happens, of course, is that once we have these plans, and this has been a big issue in Medicaid, people need to be enrolled. And I was at a dinner in D.C. where they launched a new organization called Enrolled America, which is looking to raise millions and millions of dollars to enroll people in the new programs nationwide, including Wisconsin. So the next stage of implementation will be as important as the passage stage. Hopefully by Easter, will be to the implementation stage. So that's where we are. I'd be happy. There's a whole lot of other details in these bills, which I'm happy to talk about in Q&A. The whole piece with the state and with Medicaid and with the CHIP program, this is all crucial. And so we're lucky to have such a good Department of Health Services and such a good secretary to help us implement this bill starting after Easter.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and thank you, Robert, for that very inspiring lead-in to this topic. Don't you feel like something might actually get done listening to him, right? And we're not going to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right? We're going to live to fight another day, and well, I think the president has done a marvelous job in many respects when he said he will be the last president to deal with this. I'm not so sure that's going to be true, right? So we have to get as much done as we can now and then see where we go. So I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about what we have done here in Wisconsin. I think what I'm going to say is both going to sort of precede and follow what Robert said. So hopefully we can kind of think about the topics in that order. First of all, for those of you who don't know us at the Department of Health Services, allow me to do the 10 seconds of who we are and what we do. We are the second largest agency in state government behind the Department of Corrections. I like to say that we're not the largest agency, we're just the most complicated. And we have statewide responsibility not only for the Medicaid program, but also in the areas of mental health and substance abuse, in public health, in publicly financed long-term care programs, including the family care program that you may have heard something about. We do regulation and oversight of all of the health care and long-term care facilities in the state, so hospitals, nursing homes, adult family homes, medical clinics. We run the very popular senior care prescription drug program, which goes on that list of Wisconsin innovations that of which we should be very proud. We run 7 24/7 care and treatment facilities, 3 for people with developmental disabilities and 4 that relate to various forms of mental illness. And in our spare time, we are supporting the governor and doing the work that we can in the state on healthcare reform, because as the state's health agency, this is very much in our lane, as we say. So Robert talked a bit about Badger Care Plus, and I wanted just to give you a sense of really what Governor Doyle has done in his 7 years so far as governor around, in particular, healthcare coverage, and talk to you just briefly about how that all relates to what obviously is so actively being talked about in Washington. The governor in 2006 called for us to make sure that no child in Wisconsin would be without health insurance. And again, in 21st century America, hard to believe you even have to have that conversation. But even in a state like Wisconsin, we had at one time 90,000 children in any given year going without health insurance for part of the year. And so under Badger Care Plus, we really took 3 existing sort of strands of the Medicaid program and, to the point about enrollment, simplified the enrollment process, simplified the eligibility rules, and just made the program sort of cleaner and more streamlined. We did that not just for kids, but also to cover more pregnant women and to cover more parents, low-income parents. And we're talking about people at about 200% of the federal poverty level and below. And so the result of all of that, all of those innovations, is now that about another 600, or a total of about 650,000 people in Wisconsin get their health care through Badger Care Plus. So that's, again, parents, pregnant women, and kids. Just in the last year or so, as Robert noted, we've added coverage for low-income adults without dependent children. Now, this is actually a Medicaid waiver that we negotiated with the previous administration before President Obama was elected. And the sort of premise of this program is that the federal government allows us to make payments and provide some of the funding for payments to hospitals for their uncompensated care for very low-income people. So, as you know, people without health insurance still seek medical care, and they walk in the door, and their care is not paid for, except that it is, by all of our health insurance premiums. And in addition, the federal government makes these payments. So our argument to the federal government was, you're spending this money anyway on the most expensive care in the most expensive setting. How about let us use those resources to design a program of preventive and primary care so that we can manage people's diabetes, people's hypertension, and other conditions that can be managed very well if people have access to the coverage that they need to go see a doctor. And so so that program of coverage for low-income adults without dependent children is the Badger Care Plus Core Plan. Because it's a federal waiver, because there's a federal funding source that goes with it, as Robert noted, we had a cap of about 54,000 people. And in the first about 2 or 3 months of the program, we had 68,000 people apply. And they continue to apply. So we had to cap enrollment at actually a little bit above our 54,000 cap, and now we're waiting for that number to come back down. And we have 28,000 people on the waiting list today for that program. So that's a function of a couple of things. That's a function of, even in a state like Wisconsin, where we have 66% of all of our people getting their health insurance through their employer, which, by the way, is 10 points above the national average. So picture, if we were at the national average, what this would look like. So 66% of everybody gets their health insurance through their employer. Even in a state where 98% of all people have access to some kind of health insurance coverage, be that through their employer, through Medicare, through Medicaid, through the VA, even then we've had tens of thousands of people who have come forward. Why? Because they existed anyway, right? And so we've sort of put a face on the uninsured. But also this is the impact of the recession, of course. The unemployment rate in Wisconsin doubled from November of 2008 to November of 2009. And when you double the unemployment rate, when so many people have their health insurance tied to their employment, this is what happens. And so while we anxiously await passage of some changes in Washington that we believe will help this population, and I will certainly talk more about that, Governor Doyle wants us to do something for them in the meantime. And so what we are working on now with the legislature is a 100% self-funded program called Badger Care Plus Basic. And it is indeed basic. Those of you who watched the State of the State heard the governor say, certainly not a Cadillac plan, more like a Chevy plan, and that might even be saying a bit too much. So this is a program that will be funded entirely by the premiums that people will pay for it, which are set right now at $130 a month. Now here's the challenge. Of the people on the waiting list for the core plan, about half of them are reporting no income whatsoever. So if you have no income, right, $130 is going to be a little tough to come by. But there may be people with some family support, there may be people with some amount of income who can afford to buy into this program. And some of the criticism that we've gotten in the sort of early days of talking about this has come from people who say, well, there are insurance products out there that are available to people at about this price. That's true, unless you happen to have any sort of pre-existing condition, right? So any one of 17, frankly, very common conditions will make you ineligible for that sort of coverage. That's not true under what we would do with the Badger Care Plus Basic plan. So, again, very bare bones plan. We intend it only to be a bridge back to the Badger Care Plus core plan, because eventually people will cycle off the core plan and open up new slots. Again, if you watch the State of the State, you met a wonderful couple who have been enrolled in the core plan just for a matter of months because they both lost their jobs. Now the wife has gotten a new job with health insurance, so they've been able to move off, and that's made room for somebody else to come on. And that's exactly how it should work, and that's, you know, what these programs really are there for, is to serve that sort of bridge for people. So with the strong tradition that we have in this state of not only great employer-sponsored health insurance, but also doing what we can to sort of stretch the limits of our Medicaid programs and be creative and fill in the gaps that exist for people, what does that mean for Wisconsin then when we look at the national healthcare reform picture? And I think Robert laid it out really well. First of all, you know, if you think about sort of the highest level goals of national healthcare reform, they really are cover the 48 million uninsured Americans, including people who live right here in Wisconsin, and make health insurance more affordable and more secure for everybody who has it today, as well as those who will eventually get it. And so coverage obviously comes down to that Medicaid expansion and also the health insurance exchange, among a couple of other strategies. Here's the interesting thing about the Medicaid expansions as proposed. They aren't expansions in Wisconsin, right? We cover people already to 200% of poverty in the case of all adults and 300% in the case of pregnant women, and we cover all kids, regardless of their parents' income, if they don't have access to other affordable health insurance. So what we have really been watching and working on in our own conversations in Washington has been around two things. One has been around this question of making sure that all of the people who are on that childless adults waiting list right now can be treated as newly eligible and can be swept in and can take advantage of the enhanced Medicaid coverage. The other thing to note is, again, I noted we had to negotiate this waiver under the old administration. One of the requirements of the waiver is that people have to have gone without health insurance for a full 12 months before they can even enroll in the core plan, right? So if health insurance reform passes as currently drafted, that requirement goes away. So we end up with even more people, frankly, than the people who we know about today who would be eligible and would be helped by this. But even so, in a sort of best case scenario, that program stops at 150% of poverty, and then it's a question of what happens to people at 150% and above. What happens to them is one of two things, essentially. Either the other reforms in the bill make it possible for their employer to offer even better or some health insurance coverage, and they pick up coverage through their employer, or they go into the health insurance exchange and they're able to buy, again, either as an individual or if they're working for a small business, they're able to make purchases there. And as Robert noted, we in the state already have done a lot of work thinking about health insurance purchasing exchanges. The governor wanted us to develop one to help small businesses in Wisconsin in particular. About a third of the workers in the workforce in Wisconsin work in small businesses of 50 and fewer employees, so it's not a small number of people. Of those small businesses in Wisconsin, fewer than half are able to offer health insurance of any kind to their employees. And the anecdote Robert gave you about a 35% increase in health insurance premiums for a small business is very, very common. And so every year that percentage of small businesses offering coverage declines. Every year the share of costs get shifted to employees, and it becomes more and more unaffordable. And so the exchange, if done right, really does have the potential to provide quite a lot of relief, both to small businesses, to the people who work in small businesses, and to people who are, in fact, in the Wild West of the individual insurance market. The other thing that the other sort of major goal of this whole effort is to improve affordability and stability. And again, the ways that you improve affordability in particular have to do with increasing the competition that exists in the insurance marketplace and driving down some of those costs. There also are direct tax subsidies for employers. There are direct purchasing subsidies for people who would make purchases in the exchange. So there's actual sort of money in hand to help make those purchases. The other way to work on affordability, again, as Robert said, is to work on bending the cost curve and reducing that, you know, steep increase that we've seen in medical trend. And again, this is where we, from a public health standpoint, think that this debate is also so important. Because at the end of the day, if we as a society don't work on the rates at which we smoke, the level at which we consume alcohol, a touchy subject here in Wisconsin, the number of cheeseburgers and sausages that we eat, and the sort of attendant impact on all of us. Again, not to say that all health conditions can be prevented. Clearly they cannot. But it's amazing the dollars that are spent on the health effects of things that are, in fact, otherwise preventable. Smoking is maybe the best example. We spend $3 billion in the state of Wisconsin every year on the health and productivity consequences of smoking. And no one has to smoke, right? In a particularly challenging, to me, phenomenon, you'd think that as you increase the cigarette tax, which again, reasonable people can disagree about whether that's a good social policy, but it's happening all around the country. When we increased the cigarette tax by a dollar in the year 2008, the adult smoking rate actually went up. So we are now back up above the national average. We had dropped below the national average for one brief shining year, and now we're back up above it again. And so, you know, I bring that up as an example to say that all of the strategies that are in both bills, all of the things that we are working on in Wisconsin, all the things that our excellent healthcare providers really are working hard at here in Wisconsin, have to be supported by a sort of comprehensive look at the public health implications of all of this. We know that in healthcare in Wisconsin, as around the country, we pay for widgets. And so we pay for widgets and we get more widgets. Instead of paying for outcomes, instead of saying to healthcare providers, your job is to do the very best job you can along with this whole team of healthcare professionals around you at managing the overall health of this person, your patient, and you'll be rewarded if they do better. So if they stay out of the hospital, if their, you know, diabetes is well maintained, if their blood pressure is under control, we'll make sure that you see some benefit from that. We don't do that. We pay doctors and hospitals more for, as Robert said, treating sick people. And so there are important beginnings of that reform in these bills. I want you to know that there's also a group of healthcare providers and insurance companies and large associations like the Hospital Association and the Medical Society and us who are working on those very issues here in Wisconsin. We have been able to work together to aggregate healthcare claims information, so actual claims that have been paid on about 2.5 million people in Wisconsin and de-identified, so nobody's names are attached. And what we're able to do then is overlay a computer program that groups those claims by episodes of care. So I had my knee replaced in Milwaukee. Robert had his knee replaced in Eau Claire. How did our healthcare providers do in treating us relative to one another? We also are able to look at chronic disease. So how is a person with diabetes in Marshfield managed as compared to a person with diabetes in Appleton? And it will probably not surprise you to know that there is a great deal of variability in the way healthcare is practiced in Wisconsin. Some of that's very appropriate. Different patients are different. Different people respond differently to different treatments. That's all well and good. But when you have a database, as we now do, of 2.5 million people in it, about half the state's population almost, we're able to see that there's variability that can't be explained by the underlying health conditions that people experience. And so really the next wave in all of this, as you get people covered, as you work on sort of the basics of affordability, this really is the next frontier now, to say, how do we reward quality? How do we encourage doctors and hospitals who are, you know, well-meaning professionals who want to do the right thing but are working in systems where the incentives encourage them to just do more to get paid more? How do we start to really slowly, step by step, begin to shift our thinking and say that there's a better way to do it? And so that conversation is beginning here in Wisconsin, and so sort of no matter what happens in Washington, I know that that will continue. Maybe the last thing I'll say before I wrap up is, you know, certainly the League of Women Voters has an incredibly important role to play in this, which happens to be an election year. Robert talked a lot about the fact that states are going to have a lot of discretion and a lot of choices to make when national health reform does pass. I would remind everyone that our governor, Jim Doyle, won't be governor in January of 2011. And notwithstanding the results of Massachusetts and the sort of rhetoric that's out there that this means people don't care about healthcare anymore, nothing could be further from the truth on both sides of the aisle, by the way. So, lots of evidence that people still care very much about the issues, that still people still believe change needs to happen. And so the request I would have of you, and I know it's something you were planning to do anyway, is as you do your work for this fall election cycle, please make healthcare an issue. Please ask candidates for various levels of office, not just, you know, how they would implement the changes that may happen through national health reform, but what do they plan to do about VadgerCare Plus? What do they plan to do about senior care? What do they plan to do about family care? A number of these are programs, in fact, all of them really, are programs that started under a Republican governor, have been continued and expanded, and we think improved upon in a Democratic administration. There are 1.1 million people in the state of Wisconsin now who are touched in some way by the Medicaid program every day. And so these are issues that matter greatly to vast numbers of voters in the state, both at the local and national level. So healthcare will, I'm sure, continue to be a front burner issue, and I know that you will do your part to make sure that all of us as voters are well informed about where people stand. So thank you, and with that, we'd be happy to take questions.